Good morning. This is Oklahoma Voices on KGOU. I'm Brian Hartzinski. In January, Oklahoma Senator Tom Coburn surprised political observers and constituents when he announced he would step down with 2 years left on his second term. The state's junior Republican, who's also a practicing physician, has earned the nickname Dr. No for being one of the chamber's most ardent budget and debt hawks. He'll return to private life at the end of the current session before the first of the year, and this month he's holding his final series of town hall meetings across Oklahoma. One of those took place a week ago tonight at Oklahoma City Community College. The meeting lasted about 90 minutes, so we've edited out some questions in order to run in this program's allotted hour. You can hear the complete, unabridged conversation on our website, kgou.org.
Thanks for coming out. Thanks for giving me the privilege to be able to represent this great state. The greatest part of my week is Thursday night or Friday morning when I get to come back home. And I do that every week. It's the draw within me of Oklahoma and what you all stand for and what our state stands for and the hard work and the sacrifice and the people of our state. All mixes, all types, all kinds. So it, for the last 10 years, it's flown by. It's been an honor and a privilege, and those are understatements when I say that, to be able to represent our great state. My decision to leave really didn't have anything to do with my health. I know that's not what was necessarily reported. All through my life, whether it was in business, as I left business and I went to medicine, when I left medicine and went into politics, I followed that still, small voice that has guided me in my faith in everything that I've done. And it's become very clear that that what I think about that and what it's going to be is I think I can have a greater influence outside of the Senate than I can in. And leaving is leaving. A position such as this is not fulfilling the full 6 years, but it's the right thing for me to do as I follow what I'm called to do. My health, by the way, is fine. I've got great doctors. I'm fighting a long-term battle. We all lose in the long run. You're all going to lose, and so will I. I'm 66 years old, and every day is a pleasure for me, and having a health consequence is good for us, because it redirects us to what's really important. And so it helped me listen better. So I'm excited about what the future holds for me and my grandkids and me getting to spend more time with them, but also the other things that I can do outside of the Senate that I can't do while I'm in the Senate. And so it's a time of change for Carolyn and I and our life. She's already told me I can't be home more than 4 months a year. She can't tolerate that. So I'll have to find something that keeps me out of the house for a good portion of it. She's, the last 20 years, she's been responsible for running our home. And she, quite frankly, has done a better job than I could have. So appreciate her support, my family's support. You know, as I look at our country today, what is really missing is confidence and trust and the idea that we can really accomplish what we set our mind to. And the reason that's there is because we've had failed leadership, Republican and Democrat alike. And leadership is what matters. And we need to restore that. And we're the ones that get to restore that. As private citizens, I'm going to be right there with you, trying to restore that. And that means being very selective on who we send to represent us, not voting a party label, but really checking out individuals. Because, you know, there are some great people that don't have the same label that I have. Well, I think of Angus King from Maine. He's not a Democrat. He's not a Republican. He's a true independent. And boy, does he have common sense. He doesn't look at anything from a partisan angle. He looks at it for where's the problem and how do we solve it. And so what we need to do is get more of that with my label on it. I like that Republican label, but that doesn't mean it's always right. But we need to get more of that where we're really addressing the real problems and not addressing the symptoms of it. And my hope is and my prayer, quite frankly, I teach a Sunday school class. The average age is 82. And you think there isn't some wisdom in that room from those 82 years. But we pray every Sunday and every day of the week. I actually carry my prayer list in my pocket. So I'm reminded every time I reach in my pocket what I really should be, what's most important. But we're praying for the country. And I think we all need to do that. We didn't get to where we are as a nation, the greatest nation on the history of the earth ever known to man, outside of a connection to the originator of it all. And intellectual minds can argue that, but it's foolishness in the sight of the Creator. So I think, you know, my answer to most things is go to the author and find out what he says. And you can solve a lot of problems. And we're not doing enough of that as a nation. And then we get the direction that we need to go. So with that, I'll stop talking. And the whole purpose of a town hall meeting is for me to hear from you, not me to talk all the time. And I have microphones. So hopefully we can get everybody's question answered. And it's not a debate. I'll try to answer them as honestly as I can. And some of the answers you might like and some you won't. But one thing I'm going to do is tell you what I think, and I may be wrong in it, but I'll still put it out there.
Senator, I want to say I appreciate your conservative efforts on pointing out the places where funds are being spent foolishly and unnecessarily, the various things that were on the screen that preceded this meeting. I agree with you on that, and I also am concerned about that. In many places, I do not share the optimism that you stated at the beginning. I am very fearful that not only is Congress broken, but our nation is so badly divided that it's going to be very difficult to come together and compromise on things. My concern is, and I have been to many of your grassroots meetings, I do not agree with you on most of your political decisions.
Most of them are fiscal, so... You mean other than fiscal?
Yes. Okay. But also there are some of your approaches to the fiscal side are a little bit too one-sided. It seems to me like you're protecting those who have great funds at the cost of those of us who have a lesser amount of funds. But that's not my question. My question to you, you've been in the Senate now for a number of years. You're leaving. You've done your best. I would like to know what you consider are two things non-physical that you were able to accomplish during your service in the Senate, and what are two things that you would like to see accomplished when you leave?
Well, I think the number one thing and the number two thing are both the same thing, is building reconciliation between members. You're a product of the manipulation of the media in this country. What is broken in the U.S. Senate is a majority leader, where only 20 amendments in the last year have been offered by members of the Senate on bills. Our founders created the Senate for two reasons. One is so that minority rights and minority point of view can always be protected, whether it's Republican, Whig, Democrat, progressive, it doesn't matter. The whole point was to do that. And number two is so that things would slow down, so that long-term thought and wisdom and judgment could be applied to the decisions of the House. That hadn't happened for 4.5 years in the Senate. And it hadn't happened because we don't get along. It hadn't happened because the majority leader doesn't want to put things on the floor and have amendments that might be a voice of somebody different than his philosophy. So what you've seen is the rules of the Senate be changed by breaking the rules of the Senate. And what you've seen as supposedly, when we want to pass a bill, we can, if he doesn't block it. But he blocks 95% of what's there. Just remember, when the Senate functions, everybody can offer any amendment they want to any bill. And it's a self-restraining process. That hadn't occurred in the last 4 years in the U.S. Senate. So it's, I get along great with my colleagues on the other side of the aisle. I work with them. Tom Carper and I have passed more pieces of legislation out of Homeland Security in the last 2 years than have been passed in 6 or 8 years before, because we work cordially and collegially across the aisle to build compromise to solve problems. But those bills never see the light of day because they might have amendments or they might not meet the czar of the Senate's decision on whether or not we ought to take it up, even though it might be the best thing for the country to do it. The two things I'd like to see happen is majority leader change in the Senate, whether we take control or not.
Hi, Senator.
Hi there.
I had a question about our wages. I'm not sure who's in charge of it. As I understand, there are a lot of businesses in charge of raising the wage and getting the order to make a higher wage per hour. And I wanted to see if there's anything that we can do to introduce that bill and get it moving forward, because it seems like it's been put to a stop.
Okay. I think you're talking about the minimum wage legislation. Nobody can make it today on the minimum wage. Nobody can. The most brilliant person in the world couldn't make it on the minimum wage. 75% of the people that are in minimum wage jobs, it's a first job for them. 25%, it's not. They're kind of locked in. When I look at the economic studies, reading both the progressive viewpoint and the conservative viewpoint, my conclusion comes is, in the long run, if we do hikes in the minimum wage, ultimately, the very people we say we're wanting to help will not have a true benefit from it. They may have more cash in their pocket, but when the wages work through on those type jobs, what happens is the costs go up for the very necessities that you might need. The real way to raise wages is to raise skills, to empower you. I don't know if you all remember, but I was very critical of the job training programs that the federal government run. Matter of fact, we had 47 of them. We spend $19 billion a year. All but three of them overlap, and only two of them have real metrics on them. And we did a study. We looked at all job training programs in Oklahoma, both the federal ones and the state ones. And what we found in that was that the state programs actually help people get a skill to get a job to advance themselves. What we found in the federal programs is what we were doing was very good. We were employing people and training, but we weren't training people for a life skill. So it's a combination. The best way for your wages to go up is for us to empower you with additional skills. And that bill was defeated in the Senate, was defeated in the House, and it probably won't happen, even though now it's harder because the very thing, food, rent, gasoline, are rising faster than any wage increase you might get, even if you are working at that minimum. So I think as a physician, I always try to go to the heart of the problem rather than the symptoms of the problem. The heart of the problem is we haven't given you a skill set, haven't helped you get a skill set to where you can actually empower yourself to demand a higher wage.
Nathaniel Batchelder, Senator of the Peace House in Oklahoma City. Let me say that your commitment to fiscal responsibility has actually helped some organizations I work with. So that's number one. The heart of the world is broken by the rockets and the killing and the misunderstandings in Israel and the Palestinians in Gaza, both parts. And as an activist for justice and peace, I think all of us, we just don't know quite what to do. Call for ceasefires, do the best we can. We can't make either Israel or the Palestinians do this, that, the other thing. I just want to say that in between military action, an observation of the life of the Palestinians is that they are enduring what I would say are some pretty serious human rights challenges, which others have called attention to. National and international organizations. And I think that it puts a lot of pressure on them. And while rockets are the worst way to respond to try to make a point, Then the rockets are going in both directions, and the killing, of course, is, what is it, 10 to 1 or 20 to 1 in favor. I mean, Israel could, of course, obliterate the Palestinian regions militarily immediately. So anything the Israelis do shows restraint, although in a way it doesn't look like it. I just want to ask, what more can the United States do with its influence, with its money? I know we give a lot of support, military and financial, to Israel. However, to bring this tragedy to a close. And I'll listen carefully to your reply. And I also appreciate what you've said about civil dialogue. May we all do that.
This is what's called conundrum. I can put myself in the shoes of Israel and see having several hundred rockets over several months fired with no response, and issuing warnings that if you continue to do it, we're going to be forced to act. I can put myself in the position of the Hamas, which is a terrorist organization who's actually using the Palestinians as a foil. And then I can put myself in the position of a Palestinian that's not associated with Hamas, saying, what do I do? How do I get out of this? You know, there's been instances where they forced people to rooftops on buildings they knew had paper leaflets, warning shots, everything else to say, we're getting ready to bomb this. You've got 15 minutes to get out of here. And forcing people back up through the building, put them on the rooftops to use them as a shield. Everybody's losing, including us, in this. And the only thing I know is you got to love people, even people who disagree with you. But leadership matters, and I think that's part of the question. What can we do to lead on that? We can't say we have a policy and then not live with it. So we need very clear and distinct policies. We have the power to actually do a lot of things in the world, but we're so war-weary that we've now entrenched as a country, and the world is much worse off because of it. And it's not just in the Middle East. It's in Crimea and Ukraine. It's in Afghanistan and Syria and Libya and Tunisia. It's all those areas where we had hopes for the Arab Spring, and yet we didn't lead. I think Israel made a mistake in responding so quickly to what was happening. I think they did exactly what Hamas wanted them to do, because Hamas had gone down to about 15% of support in Gaza. And I don't know where we are today. I haven't kept up with the news today. I don't know where we are. But I think, you know, restraint, strong diplomatic quietness in terms of how we're urging. I actually believe in the state of Israel. I believe they have the right to exist. Hamas does not. Their statement is they need to be eliminated. They do not believe they need to be destroyed. They do not have the right to exist as a nation. We're not going to solve this here, but it's heart-wrenching what's happening. It's heart-wrenching for even the military officer that says strike, and people are killed. I mean, war is terrible. And it's not any better in this instance. No matter which side you're on, it's terrible. And I don't blame our administration because of what's going on in Gaza and between the Palestinians and Israel. That's been going on for a long time as I read my Bible. The question is there's a way you do that, and that's loving people. And you know, loving people. My dad loved me a lot, but he whooped me a lot too. And I think a little bit of that needs to go along with it. So I don't have an answer for you other than I'm so sorry it's happening.
Thank you, Senator Coburn.
Where are we? Okay, got you. Found you.
Lloyd Smith from Edmond. Thank you for serving with distinction and godly character and conviction. We appreciate what you've done for both our state and our country. I have a question regarding budget and fiscal type situations that I know is very important to you, and I want to commend you for identifying so many examples of fraud, waste, and abuse in the federal government. And what I would like to see is a process that, when documented fraud, waste, and abuse is identified, that the agency or the department that's responsible would have their budget cut by a corresponding amount, which would then encourage them to police their own internal budget process and spending a lot better. And then secondly, along the same line, that we would put a provision in the budget that when we give foreign aid, that it's provision based on the fact that the country continues to do what's in the best interest of the United States, and that if it's not, it's immediately withdrawn or cut. And I'm just wondering why we can't do these things more effectively, because it just seems like common sense. You know, if they're wasting money, let's cut their budget by a corresponding amount. And if a country's out there like the Muslim Brotherhood, we don't need to be giving them any money. We need to have a process to immediately withdraw it. So I would be interested in how we could do that.
I think the one key thing you said in your statement is what there's a total absence of in Washington, which is common sense. No, I don't say that lightly. I mean, let me just give you an example of last week. Senator Toomey put on the transportation bill, up for a vote, an amendment that says if a bridge is damaged and has to be repaired, and you know you're going to repair it, right? If we got a highway coming up, we've got a highway going away from a bridge, and it's damaged and we need to rebuild it, you know you're going to do it, that you shouldn't have to go through a NEPA process again, the environmental impact statement, all the associated costs with that. That makes sense, right? You know you're going to build the bridge. The bridge was there already. Whatever environmental impact it has, you're not going to have any more. It got voted down in the U.S. Senate. So it tells you where we are. I agree with you 100%. I'll give you another little example. Remember sequester? And all the warnings from the president that we're going to have to lay off all these people and we're going to terminate all these people. You know how many people were actually fired during this sequester? One. You know, adversity creates opportunity. Except we never have any adversity inside the federal government because nobody ever pulls their milk chain away. And it creates creativity. I'll tell you some great things. There are some positive things happening. You know Tinker out here? The general that runs that? During sequester, she cut an additional $4 billion through good management techniques of all three of the depots throughout the country. Wow. How'd she do that? She took business principles called continuing process improvement and lean manufacturing, which she'd studied and convinced her other generals, and they made big changes, big savings for us. So it's not that it can't be done. It's that here's her initiative doing it. She's a four-star general. Her name's Wolfenberger. She's great. Now, what we need to do is copy that. And she's a proud, loyal, patriotic American that knows we're in trouble, and she's going to do her part. No, right here. She was.
Hi. I'd just like you to know that you're my idol as far as your exposing waste in government, and it makes me proud as an Oklahoman to see you nationally recognized for that. But my issue is the problems with Child Protective Services that why does the federal government pay 90% of their money based on children being removed from their homes and only like 10% that goes to try to keep the families together? That has led to a lot of problems and corruption with Child Protective Services, and like that Justina case in Massachusetts is a perfect example. And we can say in Oklahoma, well, that's Massachusetts, but I can state for fact that that happens everywhere, and it happens in Oklahoma. Since the Pinnacle Plan, there's now 11,000 kids in foster care where there was 8,000 before, and nobody is asking why has it grown, and why are a third of the foster care kids in Oklahoma County? Yeah. We've had a really bad experience with them. There's no due process, and when you get in, you're literally in a kangaroo court, and this agency needs oversight. It needs accountability. And again, I'd like to ask why 90% of the money under that Title IV-E is spent when the kids are removed from their home, and then there's adoption bonuses, and states have quotas that they have to meet to send their kids away from their families and get adopted by other people. Okay. Why is it done that way?
Well, I think a lot of things are done that way. Going back to the basic question, if you read the Constitution and the enumerated powers, and you look at the Bill of Rights, can you find the authority anywhere there for the federal government to be involved in interstate adoptions, mm-hmm. interstate family welfare, anything? Mm-hmm. So what has happened to us is a combination of things. But the first thing is abandoning the very wisdom of our founders on what they said and how we should run our country. That's why Mason put Article 5 in the Constitution, because he knew the natural tendency for republics is to degenerate away from their freedom and away from their liberty. So the real problem is the federal government's involved in it at all. Things work best under local control.
Amen.
Where things are accountable. And when we expand it, where we let the federal government tell us what, how, when, why we do everything, you lose liberty. So that's where we find ourselves today. That's why I believe we need a constitutional convention to limit the power of the federal government, and to reestablish term limits, to reestablish a balanced budget amendment, and reestablish some control over regulations that are coming out of the government, whether it's Republican president or Democrat. Both of them do. And we're losing our freedom because of what we're seeing happen with this humongous, large, unresponsive, poor judgment, lack of common sense federal government.
I'm still standing.
Yeah, I understand. And when you start behaving, I might recognize you.
This attendee has hearing problems and therefore speech problems, so she asked that I read this question that she's typed out for us. Philippians 2:4 says, each of you should look not only to his own interest, but also to the interest of others. How are you implementing this with regards to legalizing marijuana for medical use?
I don't believe marijuana should be legalized for anything. All medical studies on it, all of them, you can't find one positive. Every study done in the medical literature shows a negative correlation for people's lives and their health and their spirit in utilization of marijuana. There are two drugs available right now through the FDA for those people who say they need it for nausea or they need it for pain control. You can get both those drugs through a prescription. I think the people in Oklahoma that really want marijuana to be legalized, Colorado's open. Go there. The problems they're going to see. There was just an article in the paper 2 weeks ago. Colorado's surprised that homelessness has increased in Denver after they passed the marijuana. What do you expect? Smoking one joint is like smoking 17 cigarettes. The carcinogens in weed, and this is much more powerful weed than when I was first exposed to it, and I didn't try it, and I didn't inhale it. What the fact is what you're seeing today is far more potent. And the neuroscience associated with marijuana is that it markedly takes away initiative, markedly takes away judgment, and is a character drug for other drug addiction. So why would we do that? You know, you can say, well, we got alcohol. Well, that's bad enough. Why add another? And I understand my libertarian friends think you ought to be able to do anything, anytime, in any way. But in civil society, there has to be some limits, and that's one I think we ought to have. All right, he's behaving. It's your turn.
What is it that President Obama has done that warrants him being impeached? That's the first question I have. Are you able to answer a second question after we've done this question?
I've never said he should be impeached.
Okay. Your friends in the Republican Party have said that.
A few, but not many.
Okay. Now, how do you feel about suing President Obama?
I think it's absolutely appropriate.
Now, how many times? times, has the United States House of Representatives actually, as a body, sued the President of the United
States?
Never
before.
I'm not talking about just individuals here and there.
It's never happened.
So this is pretty much unprecedented.
Yeah, so are the actions of the President in terms of his executive order.
Yeah, I know. Now, what was it?
I just remind you, the President's 0-for-2 going to court on his executive orders. He's 0-for-2. So the court so far, the reason the House is initiating this, and I'm not in the House, the Senate hadn't initiated it, is the reason the House has initiated it because I, as a member of Congress, don't have standing to sue the President. And that's probably good, because we'd fill the courts with members of Congress when they have a temper tantrum and they don't get their way. But there's something totally different about the House of Representatives suing the President. And we'll see. The courts will decide that question. You won't decide it. I won't decide it. But the courts will decide.
Next question right here.
Senator, I heard that there is a Senate bill, and the only senator I can think of that signed on to it is Senator McCain. And I don't know if it's true or not, but if it was a law, it would make what the citizens in Murrieta, California did, turning back the illegals from Central America, that would make that a felony.
That's not true. That's not something that I'm aware of.
Okay.
And whether he introduced a bill, I don't think that's the case. Senator McCain, I heard him speak at our policy lunch this week, believes we ought to modify the 2008 law on trafficking, which created this part of this mess. The other thing was an executive order that sent a signal. Just so you all will know, the El Paso Intelligence Center interviewed with the Border Patrol the first 250 people, children, who came here, quote, teenagers, that's who they are, about why they were coming. Not one of them was coming because of poverty. Not one of them was coming because they feared for their life. They all came because they'd heard that if you get across the border, you can stay. That's the intelligence on it. So you can read a whole lot of stuff in the press, but if you read the El Paso, which the Border Patrol was, I give Jay Johnson credit. He's a great manager of Homeland Security. It's so big, he doesn't know everything that's going on. But he's going to get that agency in shape. What we need to do is fix the real problems. And the problem is we're sending a signal, come here, you won't have to go home. Well, we need to change that signal. And sending thousands home already of women with their children is sending that signal, and that's one of the reasons things are slowing down.
Senator Coburn, my name is Wes Bledsoe. I'm a citizen advocate with a perfect cause. And if there's any one person on Capitol Hill that I personally have faith in to be able to help us, it's you. Right now we have systemic failures in our state's nursing home industry, as a matter of fact, America's nursing home industry, and our government oversight agencies. In Oklahoma, we have 3,500 people who are dying basically of human rights violations every year. Across America, the number's closer to 500,000. Part of that's based on the CDC's estimate that 380,000 people are dying in nursing homes across America every year just due to infections alone. Earlier this year, the Department of Health and Human Services issued a report that one-third of people going into nursing homes for skilled care are having adverse outcomes. In fact, this past Friday, I attended the funeral of an American veteran, a Vietnam veteran, who died because of the skilled care he should have received but failed to receive adequate skilled care in a nursing home here in Oklahoma City. On May 13th, we sent a letter to President Obama that we copied you and many other congressional leaders, senators, and other federal officials pleading for investigations as well as Senate hearings and House hearings in this matter. We have nursing home operators that are diverting millions, in fact, billions of dollars from the care of nursing home residents and patients. In fact, we have one nursing home chain here in Oklahoma that's diverted easily over $100 million in the last 14 years through its real estate scheme of common ownership, where they own the licensed operating nursing home.
I want you to get to a question so we can...
So my question is, what can you do to help us launch federal investigations as well as hearings into these matters to protect our veterans, their spouses, and others who are receiving, supposed to be receiving care as patients and residents in nursing homes.
I don't know. I haven't seen your letter yet. I'm sure it's there. It hadn't gotten to me yet. I am still 4,000 letters behind because I actually go over the letters, so you don't get a form letter from me. Let's go back to the physician deal. What's the real problem? What the real problem is we're transferring people to nursing home care when we should be caring for them ourselves and our families. I mean, that's if you really get down to the moral case. The second thing is we created a system to pay for it that has been utilized both by the state and the federal government that's hard to control. The question is every nursing home patient needs an advocate, and many of them don't have it. And so you have a system of nursing homes, which is going to grow, by the way, with the baby boom generation. I've told my kids I'd just soon drive off the big daddy at 10 killer than you put me in a nursing home. I don't know if you all have ever been to Big Daddy, but it's a good fall. So I think the question is you have regulation now. You have federal regulation. You have state regulation. Why isn't it working?
That's my question. My question to you. We need help with that.
The whole point is you've everybody's passing the buck. Exactly. So really what you want is stringent, tough nursing home regulations at the state level. Now, why is the federal government involved in it? Because you're getting federal money. Every time you take federal money, you get all these rules and regs. Now, I'm the last person to defend the nursing home industry. But if you look at what is now required, you're spending money that you would be caring for patients. I've never met a poor nursing home owner, so I'm with you. I get you. I'm there. But you know, we're giving it up. We're letting them regulate. And the states, well, the federal rules, who's accountable? That's what you're really asking.
Exactly.
Who's accountable? And the answer is right now, nobody. And I'll try to get you an answer to your question and see what we can do.
Appreciate working with you. Thank you, sir.
Yes, ma'am. You were waving that hand so strong. You should have been a cheerleader.
Well, I never miss your town hall meetings, and I will miss them. And one of the things that I will miss is that when there's an incorrect premise stated, you always correct the incorrect premise. But you kind of slid over it tonight. So I want to challenge when you kept saying lack of leadership. And the gentleman over there said that he would willingly allow his Social Security to get cut. My contention is we get the government we've asked for and that we ask for this money. We ask for it. We don't turn it down. We always say the president spends too much money and there should be offsets. But when that tornado hit Moore, nobody advocated an offset.
Not you.
I mean the people. I say we have the government that we ask for, I mean the citizens. And you're saying lack of leadership, and I'm saying our representatives are giving us what we're asking for. We ask for this money. We cannot open the paper, Senator. We can't go a week that somebody isn't bragging about a grant they got.
Yeah.
So I challenge that it's not leadership, that we are the spoiled brats who want the stuff. And until we say we'll take less like that gentleman does, I don't think it's a leadership issue. I think they're giving us what we're asking for.
Well, look, that's a great point. I actually believe leadership can change things. I believe you can stand for a visionary, moral, character-based lead and talk about real issues and say, sacrifice is what we're going to have to do if we're going to get out of this. And I think a good leader can build a consensus around that. Because what happens if you don't do that? What happens if you don't? We just slide. And it gets worse and worse and worse. And economic opportunity. I mean, look at this where we are in recovery. The fact that we have $17 trillion worth of debt, $122 billion of unfunded liabilities, trillion. It's easy to mix trillion and billions and millions, isn't it? How is it that we're not addressing that right now. It is the ultimate thing that's going to bite us in the hind end. You know, we can have all the different... You know, I took a trip with Chuck Schumer to China. I flew commercially. They flew on a government jet. I said, I'm not doing that. And I met him over there. And the 3 days we were in China, what I discovered, and you all will discover this too, both the veteran gentleman here and the other gentleman who disagrees with me on everything except fiscal issues, is that 95% of the things in this country we actually agree on. We like the rule of law. We like opportunity. We want to get our kids educated. We want our kids to have opportunities. It's the 5% that we get hung up on that causes us to divide, that keeps us from doing other things that we ought to be doing. Leadership solves that problem. Leadership says, I don't have to have it my way, but we do have to address the problem. And we just haven't seen that. I was so mad at Barack Obama about 2.5 years ago. He gave a speech at Georgetown, and he said, Medicare's not in trouble. Nobody in the world other than him actually believes that. I don't think. If you look at what the trustees say on what's going to happen to Medicare Part A and Medicare Part D, you know, when the Republicans, and this is a real criticism of Republicans, I'm not against adding drugs as a senior benefit, but the Republicans passed that as a political ploy so prescription drug prices wouldn't be a part of the election that year. And the fact is if you add a benefit to Medicare, you have an obligation to figure out a funding stream to pay for it rather than charging it $13 trillion to our kids. There's no integrity in that. Yeah. So I take your point. You know, I understand the elixir is addictive. But real leadership can call people out to a higher calling, can call people to make a sacrifice when they weren't called to. Because you know what? We're all Americans. I don't care what your political party, your race, how many times you've been married, or what your children's last name is. We got to be together if we're going to get out of the troubles that are in front of us. And we need leadership that pulls us together that doesn't make political points by dividing us. Most of our problems, most people recognize Social Security is going to run out of money in 2032. Most people know Medicare Part A is going to be out of money in 2030. Most people will admit that Social Security disability will be out of money next year. So if that's the problem, why don't we all get together and say, how do we fix the problem and not think about us, but think about the generation that follows us? How do we fix it in a way with us sacrificing? I mean, my dad sacrificed. He was on the road 9-10 months a year when he was starting his business. When I loved the boy, I hardly ever saw him. But he built a business out of that. He sacrificed to give me opportunity. How do we sacrifice to give the next generation opportunity? Who's asking that question? It's a question that's got to be asked. A real leader would be asking that question. We can do better. We're all in this boat. What we got to do is quit rowing in different directions. And leadership changes that. All right, next question. Sorry for the lecture.
Doctor, talk to us for a minute about the CDC and the Ebola virus and what we know about it, and should we be concerned about it?
I'm not concerned at all. This Ebola virus, under our healthcare system where we have infection control and good technique and good processes, I'm not worried. I would actually not have any trouble treating an Ebola patient. This Ebola virus, under primitive conditions, has a 60% case fatality rate. That means 60% of the people who get it die. It's not as virulent as cases we've seen in the past. And with great care, in our country, you'd probably see a 5-7%. But I'm not worried about a mass epidemic in our country from it, because I think we have the techniques and public health officials. All those people you never see that are working behind the scenes will be called into action if we were to see that. We have, you know, I think we have a much greater risk to our health from trying to legalize marijuana than we ever would from Ebola. I also would say at the same time, I don't believe you incarcerate pot smokers. I think you use drug courts. They're fantastic. Drug courts, and Oklahoma's been pretty good at it, 67% of the people who go through a drug court never get back to drugs. Now, if you want to make an impact on somebody's life that's hooked on meth or hooked on something else, and they started with pot, they all started with pot, is send them to drug courts and don't incarcerate them. And I think if we were to do that, we'd make... I believe in drug treatment. It works. And I don't think it's a disease that you got hooked on meth. I think it's poor judgment. And then you got a physiologic addiction. But I don't think you're sick. I think you're an addict. And we can change that.
Senator, I also thank you for your service to us in Washington. Just as a side personal note, the person that Wes Bledsoe mentioned that died last week was my brother. And I was his advocate, but there were some unfortunate things that happened to him in that nursing facility. But the reason I also want to mention that I'm an advocate for my son, who is 32 years old. He has autism. He has Lennox-Gastaut syndrome. Many people aren't aware of that. It's the worst form of epilepsy. He has grand mal seizures, drop and fall seizures, every type you can imagine. In 2010, my son was having seizures. He becomes aggressive when he's having seizures, and it's documented for years in his medical records. We took him by ambulance to a hospital here in Oklahoma City, and he has been turned away many times from hospitals because he becomes aggressive. We needed help with him that day, and it was in April of 2010. Some of you may have seen the story Channel 4 was gracious enough to cover about my son while he was at the hospital. I wanted him admitted to get medication adjustments to help the seizures. He kicked a security guard, and he was charged with a felony assault and taken to the county jail on an $8,000 bond and held for 9 days. When he came out of jail, I had to get an attorney to get me in to see my son. He had a tooth broken off at the gum line. He had bloody wrists. He was staggering. He was still having seizures. And I'm just asking you the question as to who enforces the Americans with Disability Act, because when that story came out about my son, a man in Maine picked it up, put it on an iPetition. I received over 800 signatures on that petition with parents telling me similar stories of their child with autism being turned away from hospital treatment or medical treatment because of their behaviors. And I would like to know who is responsible for enforcing this. My son, before he went to jail, the top picture is how he looked. He attended a sheltered workshop. He could walk. He's now in a wheelchair. So it's full-time caregiving for him at this point.
The Department of Justice would be who would enforce that. What you see is poor judgment. Not by your son. You know, he obviously has his limitations, and that's not understood. But the fact, you know, I don't know the details, but as a physician, I would have interceded and said, hey, let's get him controlled.
Hello, Senator.
Hello.
Thank you for your services for Oklahoma. My name is Leanna Osborne Sampson. I am a council person who sits on Seminole Nation's council. I'm a representative of that nation. My question for you is about the Freedmen. We are not able to receive any services from Indian Health Services, but they do count us in the government funding. How is that?
As you know where I am on the Freedmen issue, I fully back the rights of the Freedmen in all the tribes, to be full members of the tribes. I don't know how that happens. The fact is if you're counted but you get no benefits and you're not recognized as a member of the tribe, they should not be receiving funding for you. But, you can talk to Brian Treat on my office in Washington. We've been involved in that. I think the discrimination by the tribes against their former slaves that they granted membership to, and now are changing that, is hard to defend.
Senator, if I spied on you and your committee staff, if I hacked into your computer, if I lied under oath in a hearing, wouldn't you feel compelled to have me charged with a crime or crimes? And since the head of the CIA, John Brennan, and the head of the NSA, John Clapper, admitted to these crimes, why have they not been charged?
Well, there are a lot of assumptions in your statement that aren't, in fact, true. The one thing that is factually correct is Don Clapper, General Clapper, did answer a question erroneously. What you don't know is the senator who asked that question violated the ethics rule, in my opinion, of the Senate by asking it, because he knew it would cause him to expose data that was top secret. That's number one. I sat on the Intelligence Committee, and I can tell you the vast majority of what you've heard in the media is erroneous as to your emails being tapped or your phones being tapped. And let me take a minute to explain that, because it's not good enough for me just to say it. The 215 program was set up after 9/11. Nobody's phones, and these are no phone conversations, by the way. These are just numbers. There's no phone conversation. Never gets looked at unless there's a nexus to a known terrorist outside of this country. Never gets looked at. There are 12 people that work for the federal government that get to access that. They never get to access that unless a federal judge says they can. We're about to become so distrustful of the federal government through all the erroneous crap, and I use that word, that Edward Snowden has put out, that we're about to lose our capability to defend ourselves. And there's a big movement that we're so afraid of Big Brother that we would rather not have anything and have another attack. And let me tell you something. We will have another terrorist attack. It will happen. And the 215 program has been responsible for stopping several, because we connect with who the terrorist is talking to and who that person is talking to. We don't know what they're saying. As soon as that connection is made, it's given to the FBI. It stops after that as far as the federal government, other than the FBI. The FBI, if they want to tap that phone or look at those emails, have to go before a federal judge and get permission on a show cause. Why should you be able to violate this right of a citizen of the United States? And the probable cause has to be there, or a judge doesn't give it to them. These aren't Republican judges. These are judges. They don't look at whether you're an R or D. And so we've had all this talk about how terrible the NSA is. The NSA has kept us free. And there's some things, I would rather we never have to have an NSA. That isn't the world we live in. And so what you've heard is not accurate. And let me tell you what kind of oversight we do. My staff's out at the CIA and the NSA at least once or twice a month with two or three other staff members with assigned things to check to see what are they doing. It's not carte blanche. There are checks and balances. That's how we maintain our freedom. But that voice, I can't tell you everything I know about that, because then I'd break the ethics rules. I wish I could tell you all. But on this one, I've seen it. I sleep better at night knowing we got an NSA and a CIA. And have they made some mistakes? Yes. Have they been intentional? Most of the time, no. Have your rights been 99.9999% protected? Yes. And when they haven't been, there's been a dadgum good cause, because somebody's trying to hurt us. So you can give, we can say they're all bad guys. I want to tell you what I've seen internationally as I've traveled. I've seen CIA members who you'll never know, who've given their lives for this country, never will get credit for it, never get a gold star, never get a Purple Heart, give up their families, give up their whole way of life, and embed somewhere in this country to protect us. They're my heroes. They give it all. They're just as important as our military. And they never get the recognition. What they get is the criticism. And what they do is tremendously valuable to you every day.
One final question, Dr. Coburn.
Hello, sir. Straight in front of you.
Okay, gotcha.
My name is Tiana. I do not always agree with you, but as...
Neither does my wife.
But as a citizen, I am
most... I got a mother-in-law that's never voted for me.
But... No, no. But again, as a citizen, I am very grateful to have you helping us because, frankly, you are a wonderful human being. My question is hemp. It is not marijuana.
I'm all for it.
Oh.
I think we ought to use it. It's a great production device. It's a great agricultural device. Will some people abuse it? Yes. But the vast majority of the time, that's something we can compete globally on.
The pollen from hemp will get into the air and will infect marijuana crops and actually decrease their toxicity. I think if we want to fight marijuana, we need to plant hemp everywhere.
Well, maybe not everywhere. We don't have a... Let me just interrupt. We don't have a farm program yet for it, so I'm sure as soon as we get one, we'll plant it everywhere.
I'm just saying hemp and stinging nettle and several other quote-unquote weeds have been processed in very wonderful ways into amazing fabric, fibers, and other very useful, absolutely... non-offensive products, and in fact, at one point, the U.S. government paid American farmers to grow hemp for the war effort, my family included. And many.
You sound like you're from Minnesota.
South Dakota.
South Dakota. Close. It's close.
So, yes, as a alternative fabric supporter... I would be grateful if you would continue to voice that alternative fabrics should be encouraged in Oklahoma, and that I feel that it would be good for our economy, our environment, the lack of pesticides, and the ability to grow in practically any soil with negligible amounts of water.
You got your commercial made. All right, we're out of time. We're at 7:30. First of all, thank you for being here.
I just wanted an answer about those tickets.
It makes you feel good when people are interested in what's happening. It gives you a good feeling that you're not just working for a few people, you're working for a whole lot. We don't always have town hall meetings at a time that's convenient for everybody, but the fact that you showed up means you want to be part of the solution. It really has been my privilege to represent the state of Oklahoma. It's a great state with great people. All across it. I've been everywhere in this state. There's probably not any place I haven't been in the last 10, 12 years. All my kids live in Oklahoma now. I worked hard to get them back here. Well, there's a reason for it. I want my grandchildren raised as Oklahomans. It'll do them good in the future that we're getting ready to see. So thank you again for being here. Thank you again, for Dr. Seacrest, for allowing us to be here. We appreciate it so much. God bless you all, and good night.
You've been listening to Oklahoma Senator Tom Coburn's town hall meeting recorded last Monday evening at Oklahoma City Community College. The senator also has meetings planned for today in Enid and Wednesday night in Tulsa. The views and opinions expressed this hour do not necessarily reflect those of KGOU or our licensee, the University of Oklahoma. We had to edit this program in order for it to fit in our broadcast window, but you can hear the conversation in its entirety on our website, kgou.org. Our thanks to KGOU Chief Engineer Patrick Roberts for recording this conversation as part of our mission of public service to the community. For KGOU and Oklahoma Voices, I'm Brian Hartzinski. Stay tuned next for Here and Now with national news headlines from NPR and a local update from KGOU.